Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. When David Sheff realized that his eldest son, Nick, was not just a rebellious kid experimenting with drugs, but had become a full-blown addict, he rejected common wisdom that suggested that he should let Nick hit rock bottom on his own. Instead, David spent 10 years trying to save his son's life, seeing him through overdoses, relapses, and homelessness. Now Nick is sober and healthy, and both father and son have decided to share their stories with the world. Nick's memoir, Tweak, and David's memoir, Beautiful Boy, served as the source material for the 2018 film, Beautiful Boy. And their new book, Hi, Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction, hits shelves tomorrow on January 8th. Congratulations on the book, you guys.
Oh, well, thanks so much.
I think you're going to help a lot of people. Well, after having read through it. It's interesting because we were just talking off mic earlier about what your book events are like and how people just want to talk to you about their experiences. Can you describe that for me?
Yeah, I think that, if you're dealing with most problems, people, we talk about them to our friends and our neighbors, and somehow when it's around drug use and addiction, we don't. I think there's a lot of shame and guilt. It was like that for me. I just thought, people would judge me. What would they think? I must be a terrible father that my son had become addicted. So I think that what has happened is, especially at a time when addiction is just raging across the country, killing so many of our loved ones, people feel gratified to find a place where they don't have to be alone, and they can talk and they can share their stories, and there really is power in sharing stories. And so people come up and we hear stories that are the saddest stories in the world about parents who've lost their kids, and also a lot of inspiring stories about people who have survived against, all odds.
Now, you're a journalist. You're a writer by trade, as are you, Nick, as well, a writer. So you're the inner journalist in you. Why do you think you didn't pick up on how serious Nick's problem was earlier? You know, we all have that, like, news hound sense that something's not right.
Yeah, and as both a journalist and as a father, and, we're looking and we're trying to figure out, or I was always trying to figure out how my son was doing. And yet, as you say, it took me a really long time. It took me until we were in crisis, and actually Nick disappeared once. And I look back and I think a lot of it was denial. I just didn't want to see, because if I had seen, what would I have done? A lot of it is because we're not taught, and so, like, what's the difference between a kid who's kind of sitting in the corner depressed and sad, and then they go back the next day and they're fine, or somebody who actually is suffering depression, and, Nick ended up having depression, which was related to his drug use. So some of it was not being educated. It was a combination of that, and also the fact that, teenagers are teenagers, and they're sort of good at showing us, parents, teachers, what we want to see. And so a lot of it Nick was able to keep hidden from me.
Especially smart ones like you.
Yeah, that's right.
So Nick, in your life, when you think back to that time, when did this go from being, a lot of kids experiment with drugs? When was the first time you realized that this went from being like, hey, I want to do this, to hey, I have to do this?
I mean, it definitely took me a long time to really accept the fact that addiction is a disease, and it's a disease that I have. But I will say that, looking back now, I guess in hindsight, like, I remember even the first time that I drank, I was with a friend of mine, and we stole, like, a little bit of liquor from each liquor bottle in the liquor cabinet or whatever, and we made, like, a concoction in a Snapple bottle, and we both started drinking it. My friend drank a few sips of it and was like, this is disgusting, and stopped. And for me, I just loved the feeling that it gave me immediately, and I drank the whole bottle, and then I was, like, up throwing up all night. So looking back, I can see that immediately I had a very different relationship with drugs and alcohol than my peers did. And, the thing is, I just didn't have the information to know what that meant or what that could mean. And so that has been one of the goals with Hi, our book, is to really help give young people and parents that information, because it's just not out there.
So at what point, this obviously on some level worked for you at the beginning, taking drugs. You thought it was doing something you wanted it to do.
Absolutely, that's a good point.
What was it that it was doing for you?
I mean, up until that point, I'd always felt really sort of uncomfortable in my own skin and anxious and depressed. And I just remember looking around at all the other kids in my class and feeling like they had it so together and they seemed so confident. And I just didn't feel that way at all. And so when I started drinking and smoking pot, it really did feel like the answer to my problems. It felt like, you know, it was giving me relief. But the thing that I didn't know, again, is that, you know, pot is a depressant. And so the more I was smoking, the more depressed I was getting. But the more depressed I was getting, the more pot I was smoking to try to feel better. But mm-hmm. then it would make me more depressed. And so I would smoke more pot. And it just was this vicious cycle. And again, it was just, I didn't know what was happening to me. And so I found myself, you know, at the certain point, like smoking pot from the moment I got up to the moment I went to sleep at night. And that really stopped working for me. And so I started looking for harder drugs to kind of get that feeling that I'd gotten in the beginning. And for me, you know, it was really crystal meth was the thing that I found that was kind of the one that I'd been looking for. But, you know, it's different for everyone. And you know, now with the sort of opiate crisis, the way that it is in America, it just seems more important than ever to be talking about these mm-hmm. issues.
It's interesting in the book, one of the researchers or scientists you talked to, David, describes it as addiction as a sleeping monster, that for some people it's there and the drugs just awaken it. Would you explain a little further about that?
Yeah, we know that some people are much more likely to become addicted than others. And, you know, through a lot of research, they figured out that there's a whole list of risk factors. It doesn't mean that everybody can't get addicted. If you use enough drugs, it can impact the brain in such a way that, you know, any of us can. But the earlier someone starts using, the more likely they're to be addicted. If you have addiction in your family, there absolutely is a genetic component. If you have mental illnesses, anything from depression, bipolar disorder, all of those plus conditions like learning disabilities all of those make people more susceptible to using. And it's something that few of us know. And that's why, it's all baffling. So if in high school, I think, you know, Nick would describe the experience of going out after school and they'd all hang out in the back and you'd be with 10 kids and they'd all smoke pot. And, you know, of those 10 kids, Nick may have been one, or there may have been two kids who went on to become addicted. And it is because of these predispositions, or there also are a lot of environmental factors. People are, you know, who are living in dangerous situations, abuse, when there's family turmoil. The reason it's important to know that is because for people in those situations, we need to look differently at our kids, if it's in our family, at ourselves, if we're experiencing any of those.
We're talking to David and Nick Sheff about their new book, High. Their story is the basis of the movie Beautiful Boy, which if you haven't seen it, you should check it out. What was it like when you first saw that, Nick?
It was intense and hard, but it was also sort of amazing in a way. I mean, just because, I don't know, I've been sober for 9 years actually now, and, you know, I have a very different life than I had back then. And it's not that I forget exactly how bad it was, but, you know, I'm not like living in it in the same way. So seeing the movie, it was just so authentic and everyone involved just did such an incredible job that it really was like watching our lives like reenacted on the screen. And coming out of it, I just felt so grateful to be alive, grateful to have my family back together. And I almost feel like I should watch the movie like every 6 months or something, just to like keep myself humble and also like in living in gratitude, where it's like, you know, I sweat the small stuff all the time, but really it's just such a miracle that
it's a miracle you're alive.
Yeah, that I'm alive and that, you know, I mean, my life has gotten so good, and it's not about anything external. It's really like waking up in the morning and feeling good about myself and being happy to like go for a walk with my dogs or, you know, go to dinner with my wife or something. And, you know, it's not just me. I mean, I see it with, you know, the thousands of people I've met all across the country and the millions of people across the world who have had serious drug and alcohol problems, have gotten sober, and then have these incredible lives where they really, you know, it's not to say that the addiction isn't terrible that they go through, but the process of recovery can be so rewarding that it really can feel like sort of the best thing to happen to someone is to get sober and to really live this incredible life that we get to live.
David, as you're watching the film, and I've known a couple people who've gone through this, you're watching your son depicted fictionally, but he did all these things. You stole money, you were homeless, you almost died. It was really, and it's a raw film, and it's very portrayed in a very raw way. And if there's a parent listening right now who's going through this, what can you tell them from your experience that you wish someone had told you?
Well, one of the things I wished I had been educated about addiction and drug use. I know about the ubiquity. I know that, a lot of kids are going to try it, and most kids are exposed to it, and they're going to have to figure out, what to do, which is, why we wrote this book that's aimed at young adults. But also, I wish I knew about those risk factors I was just talking about, mm-hmm. because, we have addiction in our family. We have mental illness in our family. Nick was the victim, really, is the word, of a really, really tough divorce when his mom and I got divorced when he was young. And so we know that trauma affects that. So I wish people knew this. And the other thing is that I think we have sort of a lackadaisical attitude, and we're given this message that because it's sort of normal, or it is kind of normal, we expect, a lot
kids
of kids are
going to
use, they're going to get high. It's a rite of passage. They're experimenting. I now realize that is when Nick was really young, the first time I found out he was smoking pot, I think he was only 11, and I went to see his teacher and the school counselor. And what they said to me was, the same thing. It's Nick's a great kid. He's super smart. He's great in school. He's, he's got a lot of friends. He'll be fine. But what I wish they had said is, you've got an 11-year-old boy who's smoking marijuana. And, maybe it's something we should figure out what's going on. What's going on in his life that he's getting high at 11 years old?
How are you feeling about all the talk about legalizing marijuana?
Well, I guess I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, I know that a lot of the illegality did not stop. I mean, Nick talks about when he was in high school, it was easier to get pot than it was to get alcohol even. The thing I think is most important, whatever happens, that it goes down. It seems like it's, the trend. But I think that it's important that we don't give the message at the same time that legalization says that we kind of know that the results are in and we realize that marijuana is safe. It's not harmful. Because it's a dangerous message to give to kids, because we know that adolescents' brains are developing at a really rapid pace at a time, more changes than it will for the rest of their lives. And marijuana does have an impact. The more someone smokes, the more impact. And it does affect cognitive abilities. There's a whole range of effects that there was an article today in the New York Times about research that shows that it's rare, but it can trigger schizophrenia. I mean, we need to know. So when we educate our kids, again, that's the reason for the book. It's like
education.
It's like, you got to know. You're going to make these decisions. We can't make those decisions for you. But know what's going on with your brain and decide if you want to sort of, take those risks.
How do you feel about it, Nick, about legalization?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like my dad was saying, it's complicated and I have mixed feelings about it. Addiction is, it's an equal opportunity destroyer, right? It doesn't matter what cultural background you come from, what economic background you come from, it affects everybody. But for even people that aren't going to become addicted, there is something that is really sort of sad, I think, about the fact that as a culture, we are brought up to need these substances in order to interact with each other. In order to go to a party, we need pot to smoke or we need to drink. And, to me, I guess I never looked at it that way when I was growing up, but I didn't learn how to just have a relationship with another friend or anything without using drugs as a sort of buffer. And so to me, I think the coolest thing is to really learn how to have these kind of relationships with people and participate in these life events without needing a substance to kind of numb out with. And the more we can teach young people how to do that and have those skills in order to go to a party and not need something like that in order to feel okay, I think the better we're going to be equipping them for, the rest of what life has to throw at them. And I certainly wish I'd learned those things when I was that age.
Yeah, that's an interesting part in the beginning of the book, that idea of like if you feel uncomfortable, immediately have to make it comfortable for kids. Or, you know, instead of teaching kids how to work through the sadness or work through the discomfort of standing out the party, you're not always going to fit in at the party. That idea of teaching and learning to live in discomfort,
yeah,
rather than...
I think that's right. Yeah, because, I mean, you know, the more that we teach kids that you need to fix these problems and numb out, the more they're going to keep reaching to, you know, drugs and alcohol and other forms of distraction, so that they don't have to, you know, feel any difficult feelings. And then, you know, it really just sets you up for a lifetime of these, you know, issues that can really, you know, spiral out of control.
Yeah, Nick, you would talk about being 25, but in some ways feeling like he was 15 because he'd spent 10 years getting high rather than doing what normally would happen during those years, maturing and learning about failure, learning about, you know, how to deal with conflicts with friends, with how to get dumped in a relationship, mm-hmm. whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if you don't experience those and now suddenly you're an adult, you're not prepared.
We're talking to David and Nick Sheff. Their new book is called High: Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction. I'm sort of curious about some of the terms, which I guess are a cliche, might be the right word, but sometimes cliches are true. Mm-hmm. This idea of rock bottom. Do you buy into this idea of rock bottom where you have to let somebody just fall hard, almost to the point where they can't get up?
I think that it's one of the most dangerous messages out there. I think that the rehab community has been, it's changing, but has been fixated on this idea that a person will not get well until they are so desperate that they're near death and they have hit, you know, what they would describe as rock bottom, and that to make that happen, almost to encourage that to happen, then their families, people who love them, parents, have to stand back and practice, you know, tough love. And what we know is addiction is a disease and it gets worse over time. And we know with other diseases that, you know, we don't want someone to hit rock bottom. We want to catch them before they get worse. And as one, you know, a doctor tells me, it's like waiting for somebody with diabetes to intervene and they have to lose their leg. So we want, you know, we want to practice the opposite, you know, not tough love. You know, a dad told me that he'd been told that message over and over again. He has to hit rock bottom. He has to hit rock bottom. Mm-hmm. So the dad did what he was told by these so-called professionals, and he closed the door on his son. He said, "You've got to go get help and, you know, and deal with it." And he got the call from the police that night that his son had overdosed and died. And, you know, when he wrote me, he said, you know, was my love tough enough? It's a really, really dangerous message. And I think we have to know that just like with any disease, we want to intervene as soon as we can.
From what you remember about that time, Nick, what was something that your dad did that you think back on, think, that was really helpful, thank God he did it? And then what was something he did that just didn't have the result that dad wanted?
Yeah, I mean, I just remember there was a certain point, and I'm so grateful for my dad for this, was that, I mean, I think he really wanted to understand what was going on with me. And, you know, in the past, it's not always the case for everybody who gets sober, but I relapsed a number of times. I just had a really hard time getting and staying sober. And, you know, at first when I would relapse, my dad would get really angry with me because he felt like, you know, I was making these selfish choices and I didn't care about anybody. But through the research that he did, I remember there was a time that I called him and I told him, you know, I relapsed on pills and, you know, I was really sorry, but I wanted to get help. And instead of getting angry with me, he said, "Nick, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry you're going through this. I know how hard this is." And that shift from him being blaming and angry with me to being empathetic and understanding that, you know, what I was doing, I wasn't doing it because I was having fun or I was just giving, you know, a middle finger to the world. Like, I was in a ton of pain and I would reach out to the drugs to try to feel better because it's the only thing that I'd ever known that it helped me feel better. And as soon as I did, then that phenomenon of craving would start and I just couldn't stop. And so that shift, I think, really changed things. And then just the knowledge that, you know, I knew that whenever I would ask for help, you know, my dad would do whatever he could to help me to get the treatment that I needed. And obviously that brings up a lot of other issues, which is, you know, the treatment system in this country is totally flawed, and access.
What's the biggest flaw?
Well, I mean, there's a bunch of things. One is that it just can be so expensive, prohibitively expensive. A lot of times insurance won't pay for treatment, or, you know, it's also people don't have insurance. But also a lot of the treatment centers don't rely on science-based treatment. They just rely on superstition or, you know, whatever sort of draconian whims the rehab owner has. So that's an issue in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But to know that when I wanted to get help, you know, my dad was going to do anything to help me. And the thing is, you know, I was saying there's a lot of problems with the treatment system. There also are amazing people all across the country who are working tirelessly to help addicts and alcoholics and people with mental health issues. And those are, you know, places, there are places that are county-run programs that are incredible. There are, you know, free programs that are just, you know, people working so hard. And the cool thing to know is that the help really is out there if we ask for it. It can be hard to find, and we want to, you know, work to help sort of people navigate that process
as much as we can. There's a big fat appendix in this book with a lot of information.
Right? Yes, it's a complicated, world out there with churches, how many options there are, but there are really great places, and hopefully we can help people find it.
Nick, given all that you went through, and I mean, how close you came to death in so many situations, and how close you came to losing your family and being completely estranged from them, why do you think you turned around?
I mean, part of it, I just got really lucky. I mean, I have so many friends that and loved ones that, you know, relapsed and overdosed and died and, you know, are not here anymore because of this disease. And the fact that I survived and they didn't, there's nothing but luck that can explain that. But, I do think that once I really came to understand that addiction really is a disease, it's a brain disease, I have it, and I was willing to kind of just do whatever people suggested of me, that was when things were really able to start to shift for me. And, it's just amazing now to see the life that I have. And again, not from external things, but just the way that, you know, I really love my life today. And I never thought that I would ever be able to say that. And again, it's not just me. It's, you know, millions of people across this country who have gotten sober and just seen their life open up in such a huge way. So there is a lot of hope, and we hope to be spreading that message too.
Why do you think Nick's here today, Dave?
Well, when I meet these families whose kids didn't make it, mm-hmm. It's just, you know, obviously the most heartbreaking thing in the world. And it makes me realize that it's not like I was smarter, did anything better. It's just a big part of the reason Nick is here is frankly because we were lucky, just lucky. Nick came so close to dying so many times. So, that's huge. And, you know, the reason that things are shifting a little bit in the country, I mean, Nick is right that the treatment system is a disaster. I mean, criminally so. I mean, yes, you can find some good treatment, but it's really hard to find treatment centers that are run by, you know, professionals who know what they're doing. But it is getting better. And there are some interventions. For instance, you know, right now the opioid crisis, which is killing most people who are dying of drug addiction, drug use, you know, we have medications that can prevent overdose, you know, Suboxone, buprenorphine. Mm-hmm. And they're not easily available, but things are shifting. So now you don't have to go into quote unquote rehab to get those medications. Sometimes physicians are licensed to do that, and hopefully that'll happen more and more. And Nick is on those medications, those psychiatric medications. You know, he talks about it a lot for his depression and bipolar disorder and addiction. So if you combine all those things, then maybe that's why he's here. But again, the main reason is because we're lucky. And when I sit here, you know, next to Nick, even though it's been 10 years, I never forget how lucky we are.
The name of the book is High, Everything You Want to Know About Drugs, Alcohol, and Addiction. It'll be available everywhere tomorrow, and I'm sure it's going to help a lot of people. Dave and Nick Sheff, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's great to talk to you.
We'll be right back with Clemency Burton Hill for our regular series, Classical Clemency, more after the break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. It's a new year, which means we have the pleasure of beginning at the beginning of Clemency Burton Hill's book, Year of Wonder, Classical Music to Enjoy Day by Day. Year of Wonder is a collection of classical music selections with accompanying anecdotes and backstories, one piece chosen for each day of the year by Clemmy. She is, of course, WNYC's Creative Director for Music and Arts, and she comes by every Monday to play us some music, and she teaches me things, and I like when you're here. Hi, Clemmy.
Hi, Allison. I love being here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So we're talking about Bach and Schubert, and then we have like a little extended remix.
Quite exciting. I'm not going to give too much away, spoiler alert, but today is a very special day, as we will be hearing. But I wanted to start on today's entry, which is the 7th of January.
Let me get my book here. Okay.
Yes. I love it. Your well-thumbed copy. It really makes my heart sing when I see that. Today's composer is a man called Francis Poulenc, and he was born on this very day in 1899. He was the youngest member of a group of composers who were pretty radical at the beginning of the 20th century in Paris. They were known as Les Six, and they took Paris by storm in the 1920s. And I love Poulenc's musical language, which is very witty, but it can also be really melancholy. It can be sort of acerbic but heartbreaking. And he really teases out so many different colours of the human condition in his music. And I love that about him. And it's interesting to look at the way that his music developed over the course of his career. Early on, he was openly gay. He had this reputation for being something of a hedonistic bon vivant. Then he lost a very close friend in 1936. And then during the French Resistance in World War II, he was an active part of that. We think there's some controversy over what part he actually played in the resistance, but whatever happened, he was sort of driven underground. He witnessed things that are sort of unimaginable to us, and his music took a more profound and intense and spiritual direction. But I love Poulenc for his ability to write songs that just kind of capture all of it. Oh, do you see what I did there? That was not deliberate. And he wrote in 1950, "You will find sobriety and dollar in French music, just as in German or Russian, but the French have a keener sense of proportion. We realise that somberness and good humour are not mutually exclusive. Our composers too write profound music, but when they do, it is leavened with that lightness of spirit, without which life would be unendurable." Now, I'm not going to comment on his take on German and Russian composers, but I love that idea that life is about balance. And I chose a piece for today called The Paths of Love. It's a real cabaret classic. He blends the evocative vibe of the Parisian boulevardier with a sort of valse chante, which he'd been bewitched by in his youth. And I think it just, I don't know, it sends me shuttling back to the streets of Paris. And I really love it.
That's always a good thing, to be shuttled back to the streets of Paris.
Right.
Let's take a listen. Next time if you're going to play something like that.
Or absinthe, maybe.
Yes.
A French 76. I realise that I've chosen two pieces today that really have quite intense backstories. I mean, this one was written in 1940. So that is the year that German tanks rolled into Paris. And he wrote the following year to a friend that composing the song had lifted his spirits from the menace of the occupation, which weighs on my house. "What a sad epoch is ours," he wrote, "and when and how will it all finish up?" Mm. And, you know, I think that there is this real role that music can play during occupation, during times of political tyranny. We've talked a bit about it before. You know, there's often the sense of music being the sort of background music to, you know, just a bit of entertainment, sonic air. But actually, you know, music can play a really, really powerful role in people's lives. And the next piece I chose, there is a backstory to that, which I find endlessly, profoundly moving, which is why I put it in the book.
It's January 9th and it's Verde.
Yeah, so it's the selection for the 9th of January, if you are following along in Year of Wonder. So I need you to shuttle your minds back to January 1942, if you will. A single score of Verdi's Requiem had been smuggled into the Nazi concentration camp Theresienstadt, or Terezin, in what's now the Czech Republic. And against What are unimaginable and impossible odds? A group of defiant Jewish prisoners, led by a former conductor and composer called Raphael Schechter, decide to mount a performance of Verdi's Requiem in an act that survivors will later describe as an act of spiritual resistance. And if you can imagine it, 150 prisoners coming together, working with one single tattered score of the Verdi Requiem and singing together what is indubitably a timeless masterpiece. And one of the prisoners who survived later recalled that the performances of the Verdi Requiem in Terezin allowed the performers to immerse themselves in a world of art and happiness, forget the reality of ghetto life and deportations, and gather strength to better cope with the loss of freedom. And I find it so moving that the Requiem was performed in the camp no fewer than 16 times. But as increasing numbers of prisoners began to be deported to Auschwitz and the gas chambers, the camp's numbers and the choir's numbers began to drop. And eventually there were just a handful of prisoners singing the Verdi Requiem together, but still they sang the Verdi Requiem together. And if that's not a powerful statement for what music can be, Schechter said, "We will sing to the Nazis what we cannot say." And he went on to die in Auschwitz himself. But let's have a little listen to that extraordinary music. It's a very powerful piece of music.
We're going to let you cheat and go to January 20th because of our special guest.
Yeah, this is a special edition of this slot. We are cheating. We are shuttling forward to the 20th of January and to a piece that actually, you know, I didn't mean for everything to be brought together this way, but, you know, there we have two pieces of music that are extraordinary expressions of human spiritual resistance in the face of war and death. And if we're thinking about the power of music and what it can do, there's very little that does it as efficiently as this lead or leader by Franz Schubert. And it's called Two Music. And it's a real, well, I was going to say I could read the poem out of it, because in the book I pretty much go, yep, that's it. "You noble art, in how many grey hours where life has ensnared and encircled me, have you kindled my heart to warm love? Have you transported me to a better world?" And for me, that really is what music can do. It can transport us to better worlds. And I am a great advocate for the idea that, contrary to the bad press that it sometimes gets, classical music is a very alive thing. And it is filled with extraordinary practitioners. And one of them is in New York this week. He's a bass baritone, young bass baritone called Benjamin Apple. He had a Park Avenue Armory recital yesterday, and he's got two more New York dates this week.
And he just got a huge write-up in the Times today.
He is just as we were coming in.
Yes.
The huge critics pick in the New York Times.
Hot off the press.
And so I thought it would be really fun to bring the music of Year of Wonder alive with a real human being. And so Ben is about to be your guest, Alison. You can talk to him more about his mission to make this extraordinary leader tradition, the song-singing tradition in classical music, really relevant and joyous for a new audience, an audience who don't necessarily know so much about the tradition. We could talk about a bit more about what he's up to this week in New York and then going on a tour around the rest of America. But I asked him to sing Andy Musique, which comes, as I say, from the 20th of January in Year of Wonder. And he very graciously came into the WNYC studio. And this is what happened.
Du holde kommst hin wie viel grauen Stunden, wo mich des Lebens viele Kreise umstrickt. Hast du mein Herz mit warmer Liebe entzündet? Hast du mich in eine bessere Welt entrückt? In eine bessere Welt entrückt? Oft hat ein Seufzer deine Harfe entflossen, ein süßer, heiliger Akkord von dir. Den Himmel bessere Zeiten mir erschlossen, du holde Kunst, ich danke dir dafür. Du holde Kunst, ich danke
That was lovely.
It certainly was. That was Schubert's And die Musik to Music, performed live for us by Benjamin Apple and pianist James Baillieu in the WNYC studio earlier. An exclusive performance for all of it. Thank you so much. And
thank you, Benjamin, who's sitting right here.
Exactly. It's a bit weird to talk about him now. He's actually sitting on the mic.
So we're going to have a longer conversation with Benjamin after the break. Clemmie, can you stick around for that?
Of course.
All right.
Delighted.
Stay with us. All of it will be right back. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. I'm in studio with Clemency Burton Hill. Clemmie's sticking around to join me in my conversation with Benjamin Apple. Benjamin, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is very exciting. You're about to make your U.S. You made your U.S. debut last night.
Yes.
At the Armory. And you're going to be in the United States for how long?
Almost 3 weeks, actually. Now I'm very excited about seeing different places and experience different atmospheres and meeting a lot of people.
So, Clemmie, you chose Schubert, obviously, for the 20th, and we kind of smushed it in there so we could talk to Benjamin. But you're doing a three-song cycle while in New York. Tell me a little bit about that choice.
When you think of German Lieder, Schubert is probably the father of Lieder, and he composed more than 600 songs. And particularly of his songs, they stick out the three published cycles, which is probably the most famous one is Winterreise, The Winter's Journey. Another one is called Schöne Müllerin, and the third one is Schwanengesang. And it's absolutely a big privilege, actually, to come to New York and be able to perform all three masterpieces within 5 days.
I'm going to ask you a very simple question for our audience.
There's no such thing, Allison, as a simple question, especially when it comes to classical music.
Would you describe what Lieder is?
Yeah, so Lieder is a very, very intimate art form, which was probably was founded around 1750, maybe a bit later. So it came originally from all these troubadours and so on. So now the art form is very refined. It's one voice normally singing, maybe more than one voice sometimes, but generally it's one voice with piano accompaniment. And composers picked these beautiful poems and wrote beautiful music, and very often they just met in Vienna in some houses in living rooms and made music together, and one stood up and the other one was playing the piano. And out of this gathering together over the centuries now really has been established, this kind of art form where you really go into a concert hall where one person is performing for an hour song cycle without breaks and without applause between. Wow. And very often it's like a story, like in these song cycles, for example, in Schöne Müllerin, of a young boy who falls in love with a girl, but either this girl has even not recognized him or maybe never talked to him, we don't know, but definitely she's looking after another guy and he really suffers very much. And it's a very, very emotional journey, not just for the performers, but I think also for members of the audience.
For our listeners, I would say if we're making a movie of your life, you're 36 years old, I say Armie Hammer.
Oh, yeah.
Plays you in the movie. what made you decide to go into this style of classical music singing? We're talking to Clemmie every week Mondays about how to make classical music more accessible and especially to get younger people interested in it. Why were you so interested in pursuing this?
I always say Lieder is a bubble within the bubble of classical music. And very often I think really how to make it accessible, as you say, to other people. And I go to museums in London and they're full of young people. And very often I ask myself, why are these young people not coming to concerts? So there is a barrier in a way. And I think very often we intellectualize our art form. And that's what I try really to put the focus on, the emotional impact. Because these songs, they might have texts which are quite old and maybe we're not using the same vocabulary anymore, but these songs are about emotions we all carry in us. Fear of death or losing someone or falling in love or being rejected and all these things. And I think this is something which is so much in us, and that's the point maybe how we can connect with these people or with people outside the classical bubble. I actually took some time to become a classical singer and even more a song recitalist. I before worked in a bank, then I studied business administration. But music, which I've done as a chorister, never really able to let go of music. And therefore, I think it was really very strong will to come back to classical music and to become a classical singer.
That's so interesting that you had a whole other life.
Yes.
What was it? Was there a moment that made you think, I have to follow this passion?
No, actually, I went with the flow. that was wonderful because there was, as you said, there was not a decision from one day to the next. It really took me and I just followed. And I thought that was, for me, a wonderful journey. I don't know if in life sometimes when you really have to make big decisions, sometimes you always prefer staying in your safe zone and you don't get out of that. And therefore, when you just go slowly into a direction and it takes you somewhere, very often, at least for my life, it brought me further.
We're speaking with Benjamin Apple. He's making his U.S. debut this month. He's performing at the Armory through Thursday, the 10th. Also in studio is Clemmie Burton Hill, our resident classical music expert. Why? I'm going to read this title of this New York Times piece to you, and I want your response back as a journalist and also as a musician. For a confident debut, a young singer turns to Schubert.
Well,
what do you think about his choice?
Because he's the ultimate, isn't he? He's the godfather. I was thinking about this idea that Schubert really is the originator of what we would understand to be the modern pop song. Listening to Ben talking about these kind of 3-minute melodic masterpieces often that have a bridge and have, you know, all the feels, if you like. They do, you know, heartbreak and grief and love and the girl who isn't noticing me and the boy who doesn't love me back and all the things that the modern pop song has made so much of over the last century, really. And he really was, he did set the gold standard for composers throughout the rest of history. And, you know, people who listen to Schubert might not immediately see that now. Your listeners, you know, they've never heard anti-musique perhaps before. They're not going to go, oh, yeah, now I see where the Beatles got it, or now I see where Drake gets his inspiration from. But actually, if you look at the history of music, it's indubitably true that Schubert had such a profound influence on the development of songwriting. So I think for a baritone in Ben's position, it kind of had to be Schubert, didn't it? I don't know.
I love it.
I'm glad it is.
That's what I feel. But yeah, no, definitely. It's, as you say, the connection actually to the pop music or songwriters and so on, it's so close. Maybe not, as you say, on the first view or the first listening, but it's true. And it's a connection to our world. And also, it's a very honest art form. Compared very often with opera, you have costumes, you have lights, which actually doesn't make you see even the audience. In a song recital, it's so wonderful. The audience is close. Mm-hmm. You actually connect with them. It's a dialogue. Even non-verbal or from one side, but it's a dialogue, it's a being together. And this is something very honest. There is no stage director telling you what to do. There is no conductor giving you a tempo which you don't like or so. And it's immediate and direct. And that's what I really like, performing song recitals, having this connection with an audience.
Hey, I love that you dropped Drake in a conversation about Schubert.
Of course, I mostly amazing. Do try to find ways to connect two of my great musical loves, Schubert and Drake.
And I love that you brought up opera, because in researching you, there's so much discussion about you and opera. Would you ever be interested in it?
I've done actually a few opera mm-hmm. roles, and I will do another opera in London, a Mozart opera in autumn. It's an incredible art form, and everything comes together, the costumes and the lights and the orchestra and also the emotions. But for me right now, I find this intimate art form right now more satisfying. And as I say, you get closer to an audience. You actually, all the choices you make in a recital are your own. And what I find, I compare always songs when you perform them in an evening, like walking through a park or a garden. Mm-hmm. So the parameters are always the same and the size of the garden, but you always choose a different path and you spend more time looking at this tree or this animal. And it's in songs as well. You have this freedom of finding a different interpretation every evening. And it's very, very much alive. And that's
so you have a different experience every evening
every
as well.
And of course, you wake up in the morning and the first thing what we do singers is checking the voice, if it's still here or if it's gone overnight. And then, you know, you get a phone call from a family member which upsets you, or an email. These are all influences. Or right now I walked outside in New York and it's freezing cold. So these are all influences which actually in the evening will in a certain way influence you, and you have to find a way to embrace this all and to bring it into an interpretation. And the room is different, the acoustics are different, the response of an audience is every night
the
different.
The humans are different every
exactly.
night.
Yeah, the humans and are different, I love that.
Absolutely, and that's what changes every night the performance, and you always make different choices almost in every bar and on every note. So that's a wonderful thing, and that's why I love doing these songs recitals.
Benjamin Apple will be in New York through Thursday, New Orleans, he's coming your way, Cleveland, Washington, D.C., and Portland.
Yes,
Clemmie,
exactly.
I'm going to let you choose the song that we're going to hear and the performance we're going to hear. Benjamin was nice enough to sing another song
for
us.
Benjamin did do basically all my faves. He didn't yet do any Drake for me, but I'm hoping
next time. Maybe.
A little hotline bling, it'll be good.
Give me a few weeks to prepare.
Marvin's room, I'm hoping, every step of the way. My absolute musical North Star is Bach, J.S. Bach, and it was therefore a moment of exceeding delight when through the mail I received Benjamin's latest disc, which is pure Bach. So it is an album of Bach songs for his voice, and they are so beautiful it was really hard to know what to choose. But I asked him if he would sing a little Bach, and Ben, what did you decide to do?
It's normally written for a chorus, for choir, and I sing it in a solo version with my pianist James Bayeux, and the title is Jesus bleibet meine Freude. Jesus, I don't know, stay my desire, or Jesus, man of my desire. So a wonderful chorale.
Benjamin Apple, thank you so much for coming to all of us, and best of luck on your tour.
Thank you so, so much for having me, and all the best to you.
And Clemmie, thanks as well.
Thank you.
You've been listening to all of it on WNYC.
Bleibet meine Freude. Meines Lebens.